Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. It's Friday, 22nd of November. And I'd like to start immediately by giving the floor to our colleague of OCHA, Jens is here, to tell us about this terrible year, 2024, for humanitarians. Yes, Jens.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. I'll speak a bit about aid worker security, which is something that is very close to our hearts at OCHA. Before the year is even over, 2024 has become the deadliest on record for humanitarian personnel worldwide. We have now reached and recorded deaths of 281 aid workers this year, surpassing the previous record from the whole of last year, which itself a record, was 280. The war in Gaza is driving up the numbers, and the latest entry into the aid worker security database for this November is 10 national staff killed in Gaza. Since 7th of October last year, at least 333 aid workers have been killed in Gaza alone. Most were staff members of UNRWA and our colleagues. But threats to aid workers extend beyond Gaza, with high levels of violence, kidnappings, injuries, harassment, and arbitrary detention being reported in Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, South Sudan, Sudan, Ukraine, and Yemen, among other countries. The Emergency Relief Coordinator, Tom Fletcher, decried that aid workers are being killed at an unprecedented rate. He called on states and parties to conflict to protect humanitarians, uphold international law, prosecute those responsible, and call time on this era of impunity. 6 months ago, on 24th of May, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2730 in response to the growing violence and the threats. The resolution mandates the Secretary General to recommend measures to prevent and respond to such incidents, enhance accountability, and improve protection for humanitarian personnel and their assets. These recommendations will be presented at a Security Council meeting on the 26th of November. Allow me to add that these numbers will send shockwaves around the humanitarian community, especially on the front lines of the response. The vast majority of deaths are national staff working for the United Nations, non-governmental organizations, and the Red Crescent and Red Cross movement. In fact, of the 281 killed this year alone, 268 were national staff. But them being national humanitarian staff does not make them foreigners to me. It makes them colleagues to all of us and friends to many of us. They are working courageously and selflessly in places like Gaza, Sudan, Lebanon, Ukraine, and so on. They show the best humanity has to offer, and they are getting killed in return in record numbers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens, for highlighting these terrible numbers about our colleagues who continue to do their work courageously in spite of these threats. So I'll open the floor to questions now, Nina.
Wondering, could you clarify on the, you said 333 in Gaza alone, so the number that was given since October 7th in the statement, that was for just for Gaza, or was that for the world, since it was a little unclear in your statement? Thanks.
Okay. When we talk about 2024, I'm talking about the calendar year of 2024, where we have in total 281 aid workers killed. When I talk about the numbers in Gaza alone, that is from the 7th of October last year, so a longer period of time, okay? So there are two timelines. The numbers are not incongruent. It's just different timelines. Now, of course, we can make this call that this is the deadliest year because we have been tracking this for decades, whereas, of course, the current war in Gaza is a much shorter period of time.
Sorry, do you have, would you happen to have the numbers for the global numbers since October 7th? Would you happen to have the global numbers since October 7th?
I do not have that. It is something that we can pull out from the aid worker security database, tracking from that date.
Other question from the room? Yeah, Agnes?
Yes, just to follow up on this, because last week at the, no, it was early this week, on Monday, in fact, at the UNRWA press conference here, we were told that 240 UNRWA employees were killed since 7 October. So it's between 250 and the 333 that you mentioned today. For whom those people were working for. Thank you.
The latest I have on the breakdown of the 333 aid workers killed in Gaza, many of them in the line of duty, is UNRWA staff 243, World Health Organization one staff, UNDP one staff, UNOPS one staff, UNDSS one staff, plus 33 Palestinian Red Crescent Society and volunteers, and 53 other aid workers. So we're looking at the global figures and not tracking per agency.
Okay, let me go to the platform. Emma?
Hi, Jens. Sorry to turn this into number soup, but would you know how many of the 281 are UN for this year, please? And can you just say a couple of words about whether you were taking any steps towards justice for their killings, and why not?
Thank you, Emma. What I can tell you of the numbers is that of the total of 281, 13 were international staff and 268 were national staff. I'm a little bit reluctant to go into more detail because I know some of the reports are still being triple verified, if you like, exactly whom they were working for at the time. I think the Emergency Relief Coordinator, Tom Fletcher, says it quite clearly in the quote that he has, where he calls on states and parties to conflict to protect humanitarians, uphold international law, prosecute those responsible, and call time on this era of impunity. Because we don't see a lot of prosecution of these incidents. And we should see that, of course. That's, you know, it's accountability. And people are being... Our colleagues are being killed in record numbers, and it's, of course, unacceptable.
I think the Secretary General made the same call on several occasions. Yuri.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Thank you, Jens. I have, in fact, one question and one request. The first one, can you send, please, your notes? Because there are a lot of data, as it will be easier for us to work with that. And secondly, about this year, in percentage, how many of these 281 killed in 2024 were killed in Gaza in total? I mean, is it 80% of the total, 90%, just to understand the scale of what is going on there? Thanks.
Yeah, my mathematical brain can't do that on the fly. As I say, we wanted to highlight this today because we have passed by one person last year's record already, and we're not even out of 2024. I can look into the numbers. I want to alert you to a point to the press release that we sent out about an hour ago to you. There is a link at the top directly to the aid worker security database where you can go in and you can filter per country, per national, international, per agency, and so on and so forth. So I will invite you to have a look at that and pull out these different elements from the database itself.
Gabriela?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Alessandra. I was a little bit late. I don't know if somebody already asked, but I would like to know your reactions and UN and Jens about Mr. Netanyahu being the ICC court want to detain Mr. Netanyahu and the ex-minister of defense. Do you have anything to say about that? And if you would like to see more people being judged, I mean, with all that you are saying, with that maybe they are responsible, but there are other responsibles as well. Thank you.
Okay. No, we haven't spoken about that. Just before answering, also giving the chance to Jens to answer, I don't know if there are other questions on the issue of the humanitarian killed in the line of duty. I don't see other hands up. So let me start the answer, Gabriela. Yes, of course, we are obviously aware of the issuance by the International Criminal Court of the warrants against the two Israeli officials and also the Hamas member. What I can say is obviously that, as you know, the International Criminal Court is independent. However, the Secretary General respects the work and this independence of the court. And of course, we are going to apply the guidelines that were defined by the then Secretary General Ban Ki-moon about the relationship of UN officials with people who are indicted by the International Criminal Court. That's what I can say. For the rest, is the court and the member states who are part of the court to implement, to take action. Maybe on your last part of the questions, I think the question is not if we want to see more people or less people indicted. It's the problem is accountability, as Jens just mentioned. When there are violations of international humanitarian law or international human rights law, the perpetrator have to be brought to justice. Accountability has to be secured. That is really, I think, the bottom line of the UN approach to this. And I think the Secretary General has been very clear on that and said it several times. I don't know if you want to add anything, Jens. Gabriela, you have a follow-up.
Yes. To Jens, because to kill one humanitarian worker, it's a war crime. To kill 200, 230 or 240, I don't know, but those are war crimes according to the Geneva Convention. So I don't know if you have something more to say. But also, we will expect that High Commissioner for Human Rights, the spokesperson, be there and talk about this. I mean, this is really a serious issue. So I don't know why they are not there talking about accountability.
I'll let Jens answer the first part of your question. I think the High Commissioner for Human Rights has been extremely clear on the issue of accountability. It's been also extremely clear in the latest report on the situation in Gaza about violations of human rights in this conflict. So I would really refer you to this. I would also refer you, if you have the chance, to the press briefing that the spokesperson of the Secretary General, Mr. Dujarric, gave yesterday, at the noon briefing of yesterday, where he was extensively questioned about this decision of the ICC, and he has given lots of elements of answer. I'm not going to read them all here, but please refer also to this, because I think he has been facing this issue from various angles, and it can be interesting to have a look at the answers. Jens, I don't know if you want to say something about killing humanitarians.
Thank you, Gabriela. I mean, you're right. These are numbers that defy comprehension. And killing of aid workers may amount to, as you say, war crimes. We will let the competent judicial system decide that. But the process needs to happen, okay? It needs to be clear that when this happens, there's a consequence. Mm. There's actions that are taken, and that's what we are not seeing to the extent that we want. And these frontline workers, most of them national staff, our colleagues, being killed, really doing the best humanity has to offer, is outrageous and should hopefully make people sit up and take notice. I mean, regardless of your faith or what religion you embrace, these people are doing God's work and they're being killed in response. What the hell?
Again, maybe just also as a reminder, because I'm sure you remember this, but the request for accountability and the strong call for the defense of aid workers has been very clearly expressed by the Secretary General many times. But I think one of the clearest message on this has been given on the World Humanitarian Day 2024. The speech has been distributed to you in its online, and I think the Secretary General has been extremely clear, mentioning Gaza, Sudan, and many other places where the humanitarian workers are being attacked, killed, injured, and abducted, alongside, of course, the civilians that they support. And we need accountability for all this, for all crimes. And the Secretary General said very clearly, we demand an end to attacks on humanitarians and on all civilians. We demand that governments put pressure on all parties to conflict to protect humanitarian and civilians. We demand an end to armed transfer to armies and groups that violate international law, and we demand an end to impunity so that perpetrators face justice. I think you can't be more clear than that. Clearer than that, Jamie.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Jens. I just want to make sure. I mean, the numbers are kind of going every which way, and I just want to make sure. In the meantime, I've looked on the database that you referenced in the press statement that went out a while ago. But how many of these people, of these 281, were killed in Gaza? According to the thing that I looked at, it says 230 this year in OPT, but I don't know if that's specific to Gaza. So do you have a breakdown? I mean, I know the whole 333 number from October 7th confuses things. So just for this year alone in Gaza, how many people how many humanitarian workers have been killed?
It is a valid question, and I will have to go in and look at it, because bear in mind also, Jamie, please, with these numbers, there may be a time difference between the incident happens, the incident is reported, the incident is verified, and the incident is recorded. And it's not always clear exactly when it happened. Okay?
So can I brief you on that?
Sorry?
Just for that. So the 281 that you mentioned today, or 282, or whatever it is, 281, that is for this year, happened this year. Is that correct? That does not mean carryover from December of last year, for example.
No, these are aid workers that have been killed this year, this calendar year, across the world.
Thank you very much. Jens, thanks for this appalling but important report. And I think the press release has been distributed. I've seen it has been going out, but of course, we'll come back to the journalists if you have more information on the numbers. And I would like now to go to our next point, because we've got four people waiting online, and I thank them all to brief us on the situation in Lebanon and also on the situation of refugees, displacements related to the situation in Lebanon. So I have the pleasure to have with us, and to start maybe with the WHO. We'll listen to the three agencies, and then I'll open the floor to questions. So we have Margaret with us, Margaret Harris from WHO, who has brought us Dr. Abdi Nasir Abubakar, who is the WHO representative in Lebanon, for an update on the health situation. Then UNHCR Shabia is online, and with her we have Ivo Frazen, the UNHCR representative in Lebanon, who's reaching us from there, and Gonzalo Vargas Llosa, the UNHCR representative in Syria, also calling in from Syria, on the Lebanon-Syria humanitarian and displacement crisis. And then Tommaso on my left has brought us Ramzi Saliba, who is the IFRC operations manager in Syria, calling in from Damascus on also the IFRC activities to support people fleeing. So let's start by listening to WHO. And then I go to the other colleagues, and then we will open the floor to questions on Lebanon. Margaret and Dr. Aboubakar. Margaret, I see your mic is open. I don't know who would like to start. I don't see Dr. Aboubakar.
Over to Dr. Okay. Over to Dr. Aboubakar.
I don't see him on the line.
He should be on.
Yeah, I see his name, but I don't see his face.
There he is.
Okay.
But thank you very much.
Oh, now you're there. We can see you, doctor. Please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning, colleagues. Current hostility in Lebanon, actually disproportionately has impacted the healthcare system in Lebanon. Today, uninterrupted healthcare is a lifeline to the many lives that have been upended so far. And let me give you some update and let me paint you some picture. Close to 1 million people are displaced within Lebanon's border, or 1 in 5 of the population of Lebanon, while nearly 600 people have crossed the border into Syria, reflecting that the severity of the situation in the civilian death toll as well, including more than 230 children that have died so far. As of 20th of November, there have been a nearly 3,600 confirmed deaths, more than 15,000 injured. 1 in 10 hospitals have ceased operation or been forced to reduce the services, while over 1/3 of the BHC primary healthcare centers are not operational due to the conflict. Once again, WHO calls for an end to the suffering for the civilians. The strain on the Lebanese health system is greater than ever. Hospitals, primary healthcare centers in the area of active hostility are severely impacted, and access to life-saving health services is becoming a major challenge. In response, WHO is, together with the Minister of Public Health, as well as other health partners, striving to ensure unhindered access to life-saving care. WHO is distributing first aid kits to the displaced more than 1,000 collective shelters across the country. WHO also is ensuring the health facilities, the pharmacies are stocked with the life-saving medicine, while blood banks are provided with the critical supplies for the blood transfusion. WHO also is providing technical support, but also facilitating capacity building for frontline healthcare workers in mass casualty management, especially the frontline hospitals. Severe burns and war wounds require resources and expertise. And that's why a total of 15 international emergency medical teams are in the country as we speak, with the aim of strengthening a buckling health system and to deal with the growing trauma cases. A hallmark of the conflict in Lebanon is how destructive it has been to the healthcare, and this is unprecedented in any level. Based on the WHO surveillance system for attack on healthcare, nearly 330 healthcare workers have been killed in Lebanon since 8th of October last year. What's more is 47% of these attacks on healthcare have proven fatal. At least one healthcare worker was killed. This is a higher percentage than in any conflict today across the globe. In comparison, the global average is only 13.3% based on the figures from 13 countries or territories in the same period. Between 7 October to 18 November 2024, among them, Ukraine, Sudan, occupied Palestinian territory. Depriving the civilian of access to care and targeting health providers in the breach of international humanitarian law, and the law prohibits the use of health facilities for military purpose. And even if that's the case, stringent conditions to taking action against them apply. Attacks on healthcare hit twice. First, when the healthcare workers lose their lives. Secondly, when the wounded of those injured cannot be treated, when those relying to regular care don't receive it, and when a child cannot be immunized because of shortage of healthcare workers. These figures from Lebanon reveals an extremely worrying pattern. And this morning, WHO will be issuing a press statement on the matter of healthcare attack, to which WHO cannot and will not turn on the blind eye. And together, we should continue to advocate the safety and the protection and respect of healthcare. Thank you very much.
Thank you to you, Dr. Abubakar. Let's go to UNHCR. I'll start with Ivo Freysen, the UNHCR representative in Lebanon, who's coming to us from Beirut.
Thank you very much, and good to be with you again, and thank you for the opportunity. I was going to also start with some top-line figures, but Dr. Abdi has done so already. It leads to a situation where we need to conclude that on one hand, we are commemorating Independence Day today in Lebanon. It's also more or less 2 months ago that this escalation started and intensified. But it's also a day where we see these figures accumulating and setting an increasingly sobering overall scene. In recent weeks, Israel dramatically intensified its airstrikes and ground incursions, and this has deepened the humanitarian catastrophe that has affected civilians. The past few weeks have been the deadliest and the most devastating for Lebanon and its people in decades. The situation in Lebanon, as described already, remains highly unpredictable, leaving both Lebanese and refugees uncertain about where it is actually safe. And this uncertainty is breeding, intensifying, and strengthening anxiety, fear, and
Sorry, Ivo, we lost you. You froze. Okay, you're back. You're back. If you could take back your last sentence, because we couldn't hear it all.
Yeah. Okay, I was saying that this whole situation is leading to increased anxiety, fear, and frustration across the society, all population groups. And the core principle of protecting civilians in wartime is often being ignored, putting lives at risk and deepening anger within the society. And as noted previously by the OCHA spokesperson, this also, of course, has been affecting the assistance community. UNHCR therefore calls for an urgent ceasefire to stop the spiraling violence and spare the people of Lebanon more long-lasting pain and loss. Now, on some of our most pressing priorities and what lies ahead. We are obviously very concerned about the winter and the need to ramp up winter assistance. It has started to rain, and in some areas, the first snow has fallen. So we have a huge collective effort in front of us that we need to pursue in terms of creating better conditions for all the displaced through winter assistance and improved shelter. Because the situation, as should we not be able to do so, we will see these conditions further exacerbating the situation of hundreds of vulnerable displaced people across Lebanon. UNHCR is actively advocating for equal access to shelter for all displaced populations, particularly for refugees who were already in an acutely precarious situation even before this crisis. And this has not been easy, despite relentless mediation and diplomatic efforts at all levels to ensure that also redisplaced Syrians have access to collective shelters. Since the onset of hostilities in Lebanon in October 23, UNHCR has been a leader in the delivery of essential aid in the key areas of protection, shelter, and other non-food essential items. We have reached 450,000 people, 17% of whom are Lebanese, through provision and delivery of improved shelters with partitioning, providing blankets, warm clothes, and heaters. The ongoing hostilities have torn apart countless lives, creating devastating protection concerns and leaving many individuals vulnerable and at great risk. Our protection response has reached over 100,000 people, both Lebanese and refugees. We are delivering vital services, offering counseling, community support, and creating safe spaces for those most at risk. Moreover, we support a network of 44 health facilities across the country, while providing life-saving equipment, including trauma kits. And UNHCR teams are on the ground, listening, supporting, and working tirelessly to bring back, together with the partners, the excellent partners that we are privileged to work with, a semblance of normalcy to their lives. And this in a situation where our own colleagues and colleagues of partners themselves are so often displaced or in harm's way. While we are grateful for the funds that have been quickly dispatched and provided by the international donor community to help us deliver our emergency response, we currently have only under half the funds needed to respond to the growing needs. And again, this is important because winter has started, and we see this essentially now already unfolding in a much more protracted conflict than to last well into next year in a best case scenario. We strongly urge, therefore, the international community to stand by its commitments in Paris and made elsewhere, and urgently provide much needed funding to help everyone affected by this crisis, including those who have fled to Syria and beyond. And this, I think, will segue well with the brief that Gonzalo, my colleague in Damascus, will give. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ivo. I go now to Gonzalo, Gonzalo Vargas Llosa, the UNHCR representative in Syria. Gonzalo, you are coming to us from the Idaid Yabus border crossing between Syria and Lebanon, I understand. Please go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity. Perhaps a word first on the population movement into Syria. So
Gonzalo, you are frozen. I don't know if we can try again.
About 35.
Sorry, no, Gonzalo, you were frozen. We couldn't hear you. Can you let's try again? If you can, please start again because we didn't hear.
Don't worry, I'll do this. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Let's hope it continues. Go ahead.
Perfect. Okay, let's maybe just one word on the population movement into Syria. So there's about an estimated 560,000 persons who have arrived in Syria since the 24th of September. About 65% of them are Syrians, and about 35% of them are Lebanese. Now, just to illustrate the magnitude of the Syrian arrivals, in the period between 2017 and the 23rd of September of 2024, about 400,000 Syrians returned to Syria. We have seen more or less the same number, 400,000, return in a period of 7 to 8 weeks. Now, if you add to that about 150,000 Lebanese who have arrived in Syria in the same period, I think to a country, of course, that is devastated by 13 years of war, whose infrastructure is destroyed, whose economy is destroyed, I think this gives you a very strong, sad, alarming illustration of the extraordinary pressures that this mass arrival is putting on those communities all over Syria that are receiving these arrivals. Now, the vast majority are being hosted by relatives or friends all over Syria. This extraordinary display of generosity towards Syrians and Lebanese is really exemplary. But given the poverty that those Syrians hosting them and the catastrophic economic situation in Syria, coupled with the severe underfunding of the humanitarian response, it is unclear for how long this generosity will continue, will last. And in this context, we're beginning to detect some very early signs and trends, which, if intensified over the coming weeks and months, could really evolve into something very worrying with potentially very serious consequences. So what are the, for example, we are beginning to see at the borders, including this border where I am right now, although in very small numbers, Lebanese families who are beginning to take the very difficult and potentially life-threatening decision to return to Lebanon. In some cases, because they feel that the conditions in Syria are appalling and that they may be better off in Lebanon in spite of the bombings. They feel that back home may be able to generate even just a little income and have better access to services such as health or education. Or that they may have better support systems there. Now, at this point, the numbers we're encountering at the borders are very small, maybe an average of 50 families a day or so. So compared to the over 150,000 Lebanese who have crossed into Syria since 24th of September, you know, these are small numbers. But unless there is a real injection of international support, which we have not seen yet, because the level of support is really very small compared to the needs, this number of Lebanese choosing to return home to these extraordinarily difficult circumstances may grow in the coming weeks and months. And considering that they would be going back to a country where they would again be subjected to Israeli bombings, this would be, you know, extremely worrying. We're also seeing at the borders an even smaller number for the time being of Syrians going back or trying to go back to Lebanon, primarily because of the extraordinarily dire economic conditions here in Syria. And this brings me to a third related point. I think that unless we're able to significantly step up both our humanitarian and early recovery activities, such as food, shelter support, the provision of winter clothing, and at least some modest livelihood opportunities, we cannot rule out the possibility that tensions and frictions will begin to gradually emerge between, on the one hand, Syrians who never left Syria, and those who have arrived after the 24th of September, and on the other hand, between Syrians and Lebanese. Now, just to be clear, we have not seen, as of this moment, such dangerous dynamics emerging yet in any significant manner, but we still have a possibility to prevent this if, again, donors give us quickly the means to scale up the response. Now, in terms of our own work in relation to the response, I would highlight the following very few points. It is clear that at the border, so where I am now, we have witnessed an important decrease in the pace of arrivals from a peak early on of 10 to 15,000 per day to an average now of about 2,000 or so. While the reasons may also have to do with the internal dynamics of the war inside Lebanon, it is clear from our interaction with those Syrians and Lebanese that we speak to at the border that the bombings of the IDF of border crossings, including the one where I am here, which has been bombed at least twice in the past few weeks, this has had a major effect in reducing the numbers. Syrians and Lebanese are very scared of using these escape routes. Let's remember that they are fleeing bombings in Lebanon and that the last thing they want to face is the same risk of being bombed while fleeing.
Indeed.
So our fervent appeal to the IDF would be to immediately stop these unacceptable attacks. In terms of our own role at the...
Okay. I think we have a problem with the line. Gonzalo, if you could conclude, because we don't hear you well, and we also have another speaker, so I don't know if you could conclude your remarks.
Yes, absolutely. I would I would just say that in terms of our role here, the key role now, given the decrease in the numbers crossing the borders, has shifted from the provision of material assistance to critical protection work. Our legal staff, including three or four that are outside this room, are helping to facilitate the entry both of Syrians and of Lebanese. They're trying to ensure the safe entry of those populations through a whole range of legal activities. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And let me go to the last speaker from IFRC. Tomas is here if you need to intervene. Otherwise, I give the floor to Ramzi Saliba, the IFRC operations manager in Syria. I understand calling in from Damascus. And then we will get to questions.
Good morning, and thank you for being here. I will skip a little bit the parts on the numbers as my colleagues have covered it, and to speak a little bit more to the situation and also the frontliners and the services that they're providing. So since the escalation of the conflict in Lebanon in September, around 560,000 people, as has been mentioned, have traveled to Syria in search of refuge. All of these people are now fleeing Lebanon because it's no longer safe for them, and they do carry lots of stories of grief and loss. I went to the borders crossings with Lebanon and Jdeidet Yabous, as well as in Arida and Tartous in the north, and witnessed up close the fear, but also the strength of the people in their eyes. So you can imagine thousands of people at a time crossing the border, sometimes on foot, in general, with very few possessions, only what they were able to carry. They're exhausted and trying to figure out where to go next. Many of them are children, many of them are elderly, and some have disabilities, making the journey all the more challenging. The situation is very critical, as it has been mentioned by my colleagues, as another humanitarian crisis looms, exacerbated by a lack of resources in the country and the fragility of the future. So this is a population under extreme duress, and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent Volunteers, or SARC, has been seen as people in the red vest, have shown so much empathy, and have been quickly trusted and have become a symbol of safety. They're today, as I speak, distributing food and aid, providing legal support, medical checkups, facilitating access to sanitation, shelter, and transportation towards the cities inside Syria. They're an exceptional example of humanity, and this crisis has highlighted how important their role is to Syria, a country that is under so much strain and pressure, and their work has been truly inspiring. The first weeks of the escalations were particularly intense. It led to the IFRC, together with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, taking additional steps to safeguard and protect families fleeing imminent danger. For example, in the massive crowds, there's a high risk of people getting separated, especially children, from their families. SARC volunteers handed out identification bracelets to children to try and prevent this. And more than 60 children who have become lost have been reunited with their parents this way. It was heartbreaking to witness the sheer numbers of people, and for most, this was not the first time that they'd been displaced. The thought of them having to go through this again is terrible to digest, but it was also heartening to witness the speed with which the Syrian Arab Red Crescent scaled up their response to support these people, and how smooth the coordination was between the different teams to tend to people's needs and requests in the middle of the chaos. Unfortunately, this also speaks to the fact that they've had to do this so many times before, and to me, this encapsulates the tragedy of the whole region. The needs remain immense, both in shelters and in host communities. There's a constant flow of supplies required. The general overview of the situation is much clearer in shelters, but those who have sought refuge with their relatives or in host communities in Syria often go unnoticed. It's not always immediately clear what the needs are and how dire their situation is. Bear in mind that the majority of people in Syria now live on or under poverty levels after more than 10 years of conflict, a severe economic crisis, and on top of that, the 2023 earthquake. Financial means of many host communities are limited and are now exhausted trying to cope with this new reality. The strain is also being compounded by the arrival of winter, of course. Right now, we're making plans to combat the cold weather, but these plans are hindered by a lack of funding, high fuel prices as supplies dwindle, power shortages, and the general lack of economic access to essential goods. So even if the hostilities in Lebanon end tomorrow and Syria's economic stability improves, the needs will still be there for a long time to come. Houses and livelihoods in Lebanon need to be rebuilt. This is why the IFRC needs international solidarity with the many people affected and financial support for our currently severely underfunded Middle East Crisis Emergency Appeal, so that both the Syrian Arab Red Crescent as well as the Lebanese Red Cross can continue their life-saving work, providing for the more than 600,000 people displaced people in Syria and helping them to survive winter and adjust to a very painful new reality. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Ramzi, for this update, and thanks to all the speakers who have spoken. I'll start with the questions from Dina Abisab, APTN.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question is to the UNHCR. Maybe Ivo or Gonzalo may answer this. My question is about the Lebanese who are refugees in Syria, Iraq, less numbers in Jordan also. Did they receive the title of refugees? Are they treated the same way as the Syrians who were in Lebanon since the beginning of the war were treated? Are they receiving aid, money, financial aid, or other kind of aids? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll give the floor to Gonzalo. I think he's the one to answer this.
You can hear me?
We can't see you anymore, but we can hear you.
Okay, so I put the camera on. So on the issue of the status and how they are treated, the government here, you know, does not call the Lebanese refugees. They call them brothers and sisters. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I mean, they have treated them in a very humane and very generous manner. First, by opening their borders to, you know, more than 150,000 of them.
It's very difficult to follow you, Gonzalo. Sorry,
to stay here,
Gonzalo.
Can you hear me?
No, we were cut. You were cut. Maybe Shabir.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yes. But yes. Let's try.
Can you hear me now? Okay. Let's try. So the government here is not calling the Lebanese refugees. They're calling them brothers and sisters. But in practice, they have opened the borders to them. They have given them a legal permit. Initially for 6 months. They have also given them access, free access to health, free access to education, and the Syrians themselves have opened the doors of their homes to receive them. You know, 95% of the Lebanese are staying in homes, and there's also only a very, very small percentage, about 8,000 at the moment, of Lebanese who are in collective shelters. All the rest are staying in homes. And this goes to show the extraordinary generosity of the people of Syria towards the Lebanese. Now, when it comes to us, the terminology that we use as UNHCR to describe the Lebanese is refugees, because they have fled bombings, they have fled violence, they have fled a war, and they have crossed an international to seek safety. This is in terms of the legal status. There was also a quick question, I think, about the terms, types of assistance.
Go ahead.
We're activating the same type of assistance that we give for Syrians who have crossed from Lebanon also to Lebanese, whether that's emergency support, that is where also the whole range of services that we provide through our 114 community centers all across the country, and they, like the Syrians who have arrived, will also receive cash assistance for the most vulnerable.
Thank you. Other question, Nina Larsen, AFP.
Hi, thanks. I had a question for WHO about the number of health workers killed. If you could repeat that number and also say how many have been killed since September, because I think the number was given for since October 7th last year. For IFRC, I also had a question. You were mentioning the danger of children being separated, and I was wondering if you have any examples of that or numbers on how that's happened, or if you could give any more details. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's start with Dr. Abubakar. If we can.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think to be precise, in 2023, you know, from October till December of 2020, you know, October to, we had 11 attacks on healthcare, 3 deaths of healthcare workers, and 16 injuries. And if you move to the 2024, which is the deadliest, especially September, October, November, the total attacks were 126 attacks, 223 deaths of healthcare workers, and 183 injuries. In total, what we have is 137 healthcare attacks since October 7, and we have 226 deaths and 199 injuries in total. I think almost 70% of all the deaths actually have occurred after September, October, November. These 3 months were the deadliest actually for the healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ramzi, maybe you want to answer the second question from Nina?
Yes. With massive population movements, you have thousands of people crossing at the same time. It's chaotic and it's overwhelming. So children, sometimes just by sheer number of people, do get separated from their families. So the Syrian Arab Red Crescent volunteers have protection teams set up at the borders. They've also become, with their red vest, they've become the symbol of safety. So people have flocked to them whenever there was anyone lost. Additionally, the program that they built with the identification bracelets, where they put on the bracelet the names of the children, a phone number, the names of the accompanying adults or their caretakers. And so through that, SARC was able to reunite 180 children with their parents at the borders. I hope that answers the question.
I think she has a follow-up.
Sorry, just 180 children, that would be since September, is that?
Yes.
Other questions in the room? Let me go to the platform. We have Moussa Hassi Al-Mayadin. Moussa, tu dois enlever ton... ouais, voilà, c'est bon maintenant. Je crois que tu t'es rebloqué. Il faut de nouveau débloquer le microphone.
Voilà, c'est bon maintenant? Oui,
c'est
je crois
bon.
Que c'est bon.
C'est bon.
Oui, d'abord, j'ai une petite remarque pour le représentant de UNHCR. À part le problème technique, on a une image qu'on ne peut pas utiliser pour les télévisions. L'image, elle est très, très mal, donc elle n'est pas centrée comme les autres intervenants. Ça, c'est pour la remarque technique. J'ai aussi une question pour le représentant de UNHCR. I didn't listen very well because the sound was not good. The number of Lebanese and Syrians who have been displaced to Syria, I didn't listen the number exactly. And the Lebanese in Syria, displaced in Syria, where do they live? And they receive, maybe Adina posed this question, they received any help or aid from United Nations? And I listened something about the return of Syrian people to Lebanon. It's exact? And if this this case is exact, can I know how many people from Syria to return to Lebanon? Thank you. And sorry, I have another question for WHO. Concerning the attack against health center facilities or health workers. Some of these attacks were deliberate, in your view. Thank you.
Okay, so let's start with Gonzalo. Hopefully we can hear him.
On the numbers, I mentioned that there were about 560,000 who have arrived here in Syria since the 24th of September, and I said that about 65% of them are Syrians and about 35% of them are Lebanese. Now, the vast majority of the Lebanese are staying in homes. They are either staying in homes of Syrians who have generously hosted them. Some of them, of course, have also relatives here, Lebanese relatives who are hosting them. There is a smaller number who still have some few resources and have been able to rent places for them. And then that there is a minority, about 7,000 or 8,000 of Lebanese who don't have relatives or who haven't been able to find homes with Syrians. These are the most vulnerable. About 7,000 or 8,000 of them are being accommodated in hosting centers around Libya that have been put up by the government or by humanitarian actors. They're called hosting centers, and they are staying. They are staying there. On the question of people who have come here after the 24th of September and are returning, I said that we are seeing very small numbers, perhaps an average of about 50 a day, of Lebanese who are going back to Lebanon, primarily because they're saying that the economic situation here is disastrous and that they think that they might be better off in Lebanon. Again, I stress, please, these are very small numbers compared to the 150,000 or so who have arrived. But these are early initial signs which are worrying. And what I was saying is that unless there is an injection of international support, and quite quickly, these numbers could begin to grow. Then I said that for Syrians, we're seeing an even smaller number of Syrians trying to go back to Lebanon, so less than 50 a day. And again, who are going back, who say they're going back because they cannot make ends meet here, because they're not getting enough support, and they think that they might also be better off in Lebanon. Again, these are very, very small numbers, but for us, even small numbers are worrying signals. And I said that we still have time, if we have an injection of international support, to make sure that those very small trends that we're seeing do not grow over the coming weeks and months. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Aboubakar, maybe you can answer the other question about the attacks to the health facilities. I see you're still, your mic is still muted. If you could unmute your mic, sir. I don't know what's the problem, but I can't see. I see he's still there, but Let's not forget this part of the question. Oh, Margaret, I don't know if you want to answer because we seem not to be able to connect with Aboubakar.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer.
Please.
I think it looks like the connection's frozen there. I'll just, yeah. Essentially, the question was, do we think, do we wish to assign blame? Do we wish to say who did this? We don't do that. We verify that an attack occurred. We report, but we leave it to the investigatory bodies who are in a different part of the UN system to investigate who is responsible.
Thank you very much. Agnès Pedrero, AFP.
Yes, yes, thank you. This is a question to Dr. Aboubakar, but maybe Margaret can...
I can see him back.
Okay.
I think he is there. I can see him and possibly he will speak afterwards. So go ahead, ask your question.
Yes, a question on the figure that was given about the 226... killed in Lebanon. The briefing notes that you sent and what you said is 226 health workers, but while the press release is saying that it's 226 patients and health workers, so could you clarify which one of the two is the correct one? Thank you.
Boubacar.
Yeah, thank you very much. Actually, the correction is we are referring to healthcare workers, actually, not the patients, because the patients has been counted as part of the casualty figures that I have mentioned. So the 226 are purely healthcare workers.
Thanks for clarifying. Any other question to the three agencies on Lebanon? I don't see any. So I would like to thank very, very much all the speakers who have come to us for this briefing. But before we close on the subject, I'll give the floor to Tommaso, who has a comment, final comment.
Yeah, thank you. IFRC. Yeah, thank you, Alessandra. And very quickly, as just would like to echo what Jan said before in terms of protection of colleagues of humanitarian workers. And as we are talking about Lebanon, protection is more critical now than ever, as multiple incidents, as we already heard, have occurred over the last couple of months. And also, Lebanese cross volunteers sustained injuries and got 14 vehicles damaged. And of course, this is completely unacceptable. And I just want to recall on all the parties saying that they need to give safe and unneeded access to medical teams in Lebanon as well as in Gaza. Thank you.
Before we close, sorry, Jeremy Lange, Radio France International, apparently had his hand up from the beginning, but it had disappeared on my screen. So sorry,
yeah,
Jeremy,
I
give you the floor.
I had my hand raised, yeah, since a long time. Question for WHO as well about the health workers. It seems like, okay, so I understand that nearly 50% of the attacks on health workers are being deadly in Lebanon. It's more than the global average of 13%, and it's even more than in the OPT, which is 9%. The only question I have is how come? How come we have 50% in Lebanon, and we've been reporting about Gaza for a year now, and it's only 9%? Is it because of what Agnes just asked? Is because we don't talk about patients, only health workers? But it comes as a surprise for me.
Merci, Jeremy. Désolé encore pour la main, et je donne la parole à Monsieur Aboubakar.
Yes, thank you very much. I think one of the reasons that we have more healthcare workers being killed actually is one of the things that we have noticed actually is if, you know, and I think our colleague also from IFRC have mentioned is that in Lebanon, what we are seeing in the front actually, in front line is more ambulances have been targeted. And whenever the ambulance is targeted actually, then you will have a 3, 4, or 5 paramedics that's been killed. And I think that might be the reason why we have more healthcare workers that have been targeted because of the movement of the ambulances has been very limited in most of those locations and that we have. So I think clearly the link between the number of healthcare workers killed, the number of attacks, as well as the number of transport ambulances that's been attacked, actually they correlate if you see Lebanon, as compared to the Palestine and any other locations where probably you might see that healthcare workers may be killed in health facilities and some ambulances. Majority of the healthcare workers that either injured or killed are mostly related to the ambulances or transport related. Thank you.
Thank you. Ramzi, if you want to add anything, please just raise your hand. No, I see you're not. So, okay. So is there any other question? I don't see any. Thank you very much to everyone. Let me now give the floor to our last speakers with announcements. I'll start with Isabel Piquet. Isabel, you have an announcement for ILO.
Yes. Hello. Thank you, Alessandra. A very short announcement. The International Labour Organization will release its latest global wage report next Thursday, on November 28. The report offers a comprehensive analysis on wage trends worldwide. It explores, among other things, whether wages are keeping pace with inflation and exposes widening wage gaps within and between countries. The report also tracks inequality trends since at the start of the 21st century, so the past two decades, offering a global view of how these changes are reshaping economies and affecting workers. So the press briefing will be next Thursday. ILO Director General Gilbert Ongo and wage specialist Rosalia Vázquez Álvarez will present the findings in an online briefing on the 28th of November at 10:30 Geneva time. And you're going to, we will send you the media advisory very shortly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Isabel. Any question to ILO? I don't see any. Let me see if I've missed somebody. No. Okay, so thank you very much. Let's go to Catherine. Catherine Rissou for UNCTAD also has an announcement. And thanks, Isabel.
Oui, bonjour à tous. Rapidement, donc il est déjà tard, je voulais attirer votre attention sur une réunion qui commence lundi, examiner le coût du financement pour atteindre les objectifs de développement durable sera le propos des experts qui se réuniront la semaine prochaine au Palais des Nations, ce sera en salle 17, ce sont des experts intergouvernementaux. Cette réunion fait partie des travaux qui vont nourrir la quatrième conférence internationale sur le financement du développement qui se tiendra à Séville, en Espagne, fin juin 2025 et qui devra trouver des solutions financières face à l'urgence de réaliser pleinement les objectifs de développement durable et de procéder à la réforme de l'architecture financière internationale, sujet sur lequel la CNUSED travaille depuis très longtemps. Depuis son discours, du 18 novembre au Brésil, Rebecca Greenspan, secrétaire générale de la CNUSED, a exhorté les dirigeants du G20 à renforcer leur soutien aux pays du Sud, rappelant le rôle croissant de leur pays dans la conduite de l'économie mondiale. Au cours des 5 prochaines années, le PIB mondial augmentera de 55 000 milliards de dollars, dont 70% proviendront des pays du Sud. C'est dans sa déclaration lors de la réunion du G20. Notons que ce chiffre, donc les 70% d'augmentation, équivaut à la taille de l'économie mondiale il y a 20 ans, date de la création du G20. Mais revenons à la réunion de la semaine prochaine. Les principales questions qui seront en débat seront par exemple comment réduire les coûts du financement du développement. On sait que les taux sont plus élevés pour les pays en développement que pour les pays développés. Quelles solutions pour garantir la sécurité alimentaire, pour pousser la transition énergétique et la transition numérique? On sait que ça va coûter des milliers de dollars. Quel est le rôle des institutions financières pour rendre le financement plus abordable? Parlons-nous de dons ou de prêts de la part de ces institutions financières? Et quel est l'impact des notes attribuées par les agences de notation sur le financement du développement? Surtout quand elles sont mauvaises, qui est le cas souvent des pays en développement. Ce point sera discuté mercredi matin. Il est intéressant de voir que les notes attribuées influencent directement le coût des emprunts des pays en développement sur les marchés financiers et que les biais dans les notations nuisent de manière disproportionnée aux pays en développement par rapport aux pays développés. Vous pouvez écouter les discussions en ligne ou venir en salle 17. Donc ça commence lundi matin jusqu'à mercredi après-midi. Et je pense que nous aurons une news ou un communiqué sur la session qui dure donc 3 jours. Voilà, je suis à votre disposition pour vous mettre en contact avec les participants. Vous avez tout dans le lien qui sera dans les notes, le lien vers le programme, vers la réunion et vers le bouton d'enregistrement qui passe par Indico. Vous connaissez la procédure. Merci beaucoup.
Merci à toi, Catherine. Des questions pour la CNUSED ? Je ne vois pas, c'est parfait. Juste un rappel de la part de collègues du Bureau des droits de l'homme, de l'Office des droits de l'homme et du Conseil. Il y a deux... pardon, j'ai passé au français. Sorry. Back into English. Just a reminder from our colleagues of the Human Rights Council about the UN Forum on Business and Human Rights, which will start on Monday at the Palais and will continue until Wednesday, 27th of November. The title the theme for this meeting is Realizing the Smart Mix of Measures to Protect Human Rights in the Context of Business Activities. And then starting the 28th, so the day after, until the 29th of November, they will also held the UN Forum on Minority Rights. So, of course, you can contact the colleagues for more if you have a question for more information. We have already spoken about the ILO press conference. I also have to remind you about the Tuesday, 26th of November, UNAIDS press conference. This is for the launch of the World AIDS report. Sorry, World AIDS Day report, 2024. Entitled Take the Rights Path. And this is, as I said, on Tuesday at 2 p.m. You will have Winnie Bienamina, the Executive Director of UNAIDS, Axel Bautista, Community Engagement Manager of Impact Mexico City, Alexandra Calmi, Head of the HIV Services at the Geneva University Hospitals, and Jean Gapia Nyonzima, the Chair of the National Association for Support for HIV and People Living with AIDS in Burundi. And then on Wednesday, 27th of November at 11 a.m., FAO will organize the media launch of the FAO State of Agriculture Commodity Markets 2024. The title is Trade and Nutrition Policy Coherence for Healthy Diets. The report is embargoed, and the press conference is embargoed until the 29th of November at 1:30 p.m. Geneva time. So Wednesday, 27th of November, 11 a.m., the press conference, embargoed until the 29th at 1:30. So the presser and the report. The speakers for the press conference on the Wednesday, 27th of November, will be George Rapsomanikis, the FAO senior economist and lead author of the report, Nancy Aburto, the FAO deputy director of Food and Nutrition Division, and Andrea Zimmermann, FAO economist. And just a very last point about the committees. So the Committee Against Torture is closing this morning the 81st session, and the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination will open next Monday at 10 a.m. It's 114th session, which will last until the 13th of December. The countries that they will review under this session will be Ecuador, Saudi Arabia, Monaco, Armenia, Greece, and Kenya. And that is all I had for you. If there are questions, I don't see any. So thank you very much. Let me wish you a very good weekend, and to next week. Thank you.